You're turning there, I'll tell you something about our family. If you don't already know this, we love to hike. Probably, if you ask my children some of their favorite things to do, hopefully, you never know for sure what will come out of their mouths, but at some point, they'll probably say hiking. When we go on vacation, we love to find places to hike. We'll often, even throughout the week, we'll find somewhere to go and take a walk together as a family. It's something that we love to do together. And one of the things that Landon, our oldest, has been intrigued with in recent months are the markings that you find on trails. So recently we were at West Hills Park just over here, and we were on the Red Trail. And I was having him make sure that we stayed on the Red Trail. And he's been very interested with this, and it's important to learn when going hiking that you stay on the right trail. He also will sometimes still mention to us something that he and his grandpa did just last year, where they took a hike together and grandpa was teaching him what it meant to blaze a trail. And all of this I bring up because this idea of staying on the right path or on the right trail is going to be really important for us as we get to this next section in Ruth today. Whenever you're on a journey or on a path, you always want to make sure you're going the right direction. Because, as sometimes we hear people say, doesn't matter how fast you get there if you get to the wrong place, right? You want to make sure that you're going the right place and you're doing it the right way. And I want to keep that idea with us as we go throughout the message. Last week, we began a series that I'm calling Redemption in Ruth, a gospel preview. Redemption in Ruth, a gospel preview. And we started off last time talking about the problem of redemption. Now again, if you weren't here, we're not saying that there is any problem with redemption itself, but that there is a problem that necessitates redemption. It is at the background of the redemption story of Ruth, it's at the background of the redemption story of the Bible, and it's at the background of your story too. We called it the exile of sin. And we learned that sin does bring this exile, this separation, separation from God and separation from life as God intended it. Now this week, I want to build off this idea of the path, and I want to discuss the path of redemption. I want to talk about the path that leads to redemption. What is it like? What happens on that path? Today, I want us to see what it looks like to travel on the path that eventuates in redemption. And I'm going to give you a sneak peek of what we will learn through the subtitle of this week. So today's message is The Path of Redemption, Turning and Trusting. The Path of Redemption, Turning and Trusting. Now, we'll take the sermon to develop what I mean by turning and trusting, but that is what we're going to look at today, and we're going to see it from the next section in Ruth. My goal today, I don't know that I'll quite do it, it would be to get through the next four scenes. We may only get through three. But just like last week, the way that I want to go about this is I'm going to introduce each scene and give a title for it, and then I'm going to read the text that explains what goes on in that scene, and then we'll go back through it and give some more detail about what we learn. And then at the very end, after we've explained it, I'm going to try to highlight one main idea that we take. So if we get through three scenes, we'll get three, and hopefully we'll get four. So let's jump in. Scene number one begins where we left off last week. We ended with verse 13 last time in Ruth chapter 1. And now in scene 1 of this week, we find ourselves on the path from Moab to Israel. And this scene, we could call it a scene of entrusting. This is where we're going to see this loyalty of Ruth proclaimed to Naomi. I'm going to tell you at the outset what I really hope that we see from these short verses. Here it is, that trusting is essential on the path of redemption. Trusting is essential on the path of redemption. Read with me Ruth 1, 14 to 18. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. If you remember from last week, we ended last week with Naomi three times looking at her two daughters-in-law and saying, in essence, you need to return. There's not hope for you with me. And if you remember, what she was talking about is she was saying, you now need husbands for this security, and it's not likely you're going to find them from me. I don't have any more sons, and I'm not going to. And so go back to Moab and find your husbands there. And so we find in verse 14 that this is a very sad time. This information in verse 14 highlights the emotion of this occasion. Again, none of these women are actually blood relatives, but what becomes clear is they have become very close. This was emotionally taxing on each of them. There was a real family bond that had developed over the years in each of their lives. And then at the end of the verse, we find what happens. And we actually find, if we continue our trail analogy, that there's a bit of a fork in the road here. There are two ways to go. We find Orpah kissing her mother-in-law, and then we'll find returning, while Ruth clings to her. I think that this note is essential to our message today, and we're going to get to it throughout. But right now, I just want you to see that it says Ruth clung to her. That word is so important. It means, as it says, it's clinging. She is holding on. She is committing herself to Naomi. We're going to find that with her words that she's about to say in just a moment. But before Ruth is able to express her feelings at the time and her thoughts and her commitments, Naomi comes back to her. And she says, your sister-in-law has now returned. It's time for you to return. And what I want you to see there is how Naomi speaks of this return. Probably based on last week, we would have expected Naomi to say something like this. Return after your sister-in-law, she's returned to find a husband in Moab. It's now time for you to do the same. But that is not what Naomi says. Naomi sees this return as something more than just that. She says that this is a choice of people and of gods. This is not just merely a choice of where best to find a husband. This is also a choice of who to be with and who to serve. At this point, let's just be aware, but the significance of this is going to become more and more clear as we work through the passage today and through the rest of this book. And so, I think it's interesting, though, that even with Naomi putting it in those terms, she still looks at Ruth and says, I think it's better for you to go to that people and those gods. Now, these next couple verses are so important because we hear from Ruth's own mouth her commitment and what she sees as the right decision. And she also sees this as more than just the best place to find a husband, but she sees this as something so much deeper. Ruth makes clear in verses 16 and following that her decision is a decision not just about Naomi or not just about a husband. This is a decision about ultimate allegiances, her allegiance to a people, her allegiance to a national or even communal identity, but even more than that, her allegiance to a god, her religious or her worship identity. And these powerful verses, Ruth in essence says, wherever you are, I will be. And then says, whoever you worship, your God will be my God and your people will be my people. Now, the significance of these two verses that we read, verses 16 and 17, are not reflected in the amount of time given to them in the text. And it's also not going to be reflected by the time given to them in the sermon. I'm actually not going to spend too much more time on them. But I think that that's appropriate, and here's why. These two verses, when we read them, we realize, just hearing them, just reading them, that they are of great importance, that this is like a line in the sand moment, and yet we do not dwell on them. We are meant to dwell on them as we work through the rest of the book, which is exactly what we'll do. Keep these verses in mind as we go forward. But I do want you to see what she says at the end of verse 17. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse if anything but death parts you and me. Ruth actually takes an oath here, and she pronounces judgment upon herself for unfaithfulness. This is a line in the sand moment, and she says if she goes back across this line, so to speak, that she is calling judgment upon herself. There is no turning back in Ruth's mind from this decision. And I think this is very clear to Naomi because verse 18 says this, that Naomi saw that there was determination in Ruth. And at that point, she stopped pressing. She sees that Ruth is determined to pursue this path, and so she acquiesces to Ruth's will. I just want to point out to us that there is a real contrast of commitments that we are struck with in these first verses today. We have the contrast between Naomi and Ruth's commitments, where Naomi is actually the one seeking to encourage Ruth to go back, but Ruth sees this for what it is and says, no, I am following you. The same thing between Ruth and Orpah. Orpah, this seems like maybe just another step in her path of life. We don't know what happens to her, but we assume that maybe she did go back and she found a husband in Moab and she continued on in her life. And though this is surely an important moment in her life, we don't maybe get the idea that this was the life-changing moment of her life. Whereas for Ruth, this is the point of no return. All of this, what I'm trying to point out here at the beginning, shows Ruth's commitment and loyalty. And this is going to be so important to us as we work our way through the rest of this story. And so it's important for us to notice it here. So we're really at the end. We're kind of at this crossroads, so to speak, on the path from Moab to Israel. And what I'm going to do at the end of each scene is I'm going to draw out one word for us that's going to highlight the main idea that I'm drawing out. The word here is that word cling that I pointed to. And this word is actually going to be used four times throughout our passage today. It's used here in 1:14, and then it's going to be used three times in chapter 2. I think one of the things that's really interesting about this word clinging is it can refer to someone physically latching on to someone else or something else and holding on. But if we've been reading along in our Bibles up to this point, the books historically prior to Ruth have used this in another way. They use it to people clinging to God. I found there were four times in Deuteronomy. Let me just give you one example of this. In Deuteronomy 30, verse 20, we read that the people were to love the Lord your God by obeying his voice, by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days. There are also two times in Joshua. I'm not going to read them. But I think that this word is important because Hebrew readers of this book, when they read cling, of course, they're going to be thinking about the fact that Ruth is holding on to her mother-in-law as they are crying, as this is an emotional time. But I think it would also be preparing, as they're thinking about loyalty and faithfulness, there's someone else that should be clung to. And actually, Ruth's words state that very thing, that she is making an allegiance not only to Naomi, but in clinging to Naomi, she is clinging to Naomi's God. I think that leads me to this first main point from this scene, that trusting is always essential on the path of redemption. Every redemption story includes trusting, or could I say, clinging. Remember that we learned last week that at the background of every story of redemption is sin. And this crisis of sin is something that not we or anyone can deal with on our own. I think in repeating this idea of clinging throughout the early chapters of Ruth, the author is pointing our attention to the fact that true redemption is going to necessitate clinging to someone in faith and trust. Now, Ruth, we're going to see, clings to Naomi in just a few more verses. We're going to see that she's going to start clinging to someone else in need and dependence to provide for her. But I think the full significance of Ruth's faith and trust will become more and more clear as we go through this story. But right now, I just want to say this, that trusting is essential on the path of redemption. Let's go to the second scene.
verse 19, we shift. We're no longer between Moab and Israel. We are actually in Israel now. We are at the gates of Bethlehem. We're in the city of Bethlehem, and this scene could be called returning. They're back. The journey is completed here. And this gets to the other main idea that I said is going to be central to our sermon, and it's this, that turning is also essential on the path of redemption. Now, I'll explain why I say it that way in just a moment. But right now, I just want you to read with me verses 19 through the end of the chapter, 19 to 22. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So they go along this path until they return. And it's amazing, they get back and all of Bethlehem is stirred up about this. And the women are really interested and they come and they say, "Is this Naomi?" Now, I don't know all the reasons that they said that, but it seems that we can at least take two things from this. That Naomi was remembered, even though she'd sojourned for at least 10 years at this point in Moab. But it also says that even people that just generally knew her recognized something else, that Naomi was different. And Naomi was surely remembered because they were wondering, is this her? But something about him gave them pause because there was something different about her. And Naomi is going to be very upfront with what she believes is different about her in the next verses. She comes to them and she says, "Do not call me Naomi, but call me Mara." If you remember last week, we talked about the importance of names in Ruth and even throughout much of the Old Testament. And remember, Naomi means pleasant. So Naomi, that name, pleasant. Mara means bitter. So Naomi is saying to them, "Do not think of me as pleasant. Think of me as bitter." Well, why, Naomi? Why should we think of you as so bitter? What's wrong? Well, she says in verses 20 and 21, she says exactly what she perceives as the bitterness about her. She says that God, the Almighty, has dealt very bitterly with me. She went out full, but the Lord brought her back empty. And I think that this is really important for us to listen to what Naomi says her evaluation of her situation is. She sees that her situation is the result of God's hand. She doesn't say that she's just had a bad luck or a bad go of it, or what we hear often today, that the universe is just against her. She sees that there is a personal rift between her and the living God. This bitterness extends to her very perception of her identity. As we've already seen and talked about, these names were of great significance. So she no longer wants to go by pleasant Naomi, but rather bitter Mara. I think this ties into what we talked about last week, that when Elimelech and his family, and really all of Israel in the period of the Judges, were living in such sin, they were experiencing God's covenant curses that he promised on his people. And I wonder if Naomi is recognizing that. That in her exile of sin, in her sojourning, in her disobedience that she and her family and even her own nation has gone through, I wonder if she's beginning to recognize that that's what the bitterness of her life is from. Yes, Israel was unfaithful in this period. She and her family were unfaithful, and both experienced God's judgment. And so, verse 22 gives the summary of everything. They return, and then the final words set us up for the action of chapter 2. But before going on to the next scene, I want to pull out a really important word, and I want to talk about it for a moment. I've already stated it in the way that I stated the sermon title and the way that I stated this section, this scene. There's a really important word that we see all throughout chapter 1 into chapter 2. It's the word shuv. We see it translated as turn or return. If you begin to count up the number of times that this occurs, it occurs 7 times from verse 15 into chapter 2. And if you go into last week's section, it occurs 6 more times. So we have 13 times where an original reader would be reading again and again and again that people are turning or returning. Now, this is also a very important word in the Old Testament. It is the word, the root, that is often used throughout the Old Testament to speak of repentance. Now, that may be surprising. It can, in the same way as what we saw last time, it is a word that can have a physical meaning of turning around, turning this way, turning that way. But it can also have this metaphorical spiritual understanding of turning to God from sin. There are many, many, many examples of this. But let me just give you a couple because I think it highlights the significance of some things that we're going to learn from Ruth. 2 Chronicles 7:14. My people who are called by my name, if they humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways. The prophet Ezekiel loves this phrase. I don't even know how many times he uses it. But here are a couple examples. Here's an example. Ezekiel 33:11 says, "As I say, declares the Lord, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn back from your evil ways." Jonah 3 and verse 8, "Both man and beast must be covered with sackcloth, and let men call on God earnestly, that each may turn from his wicked way and from the violence which is in his hands." Or maybe this, Psalm 51, a passage that we're familiar with, verse 13, "Then, after he gets right with God, I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will be converted or turned to you." I say this because, again, I think that God, as the glorious, masterful author, and whoever this human author were, I do not think it's a stretch to say that a reader reading this word turn, turn, turn over and over again, in the context of people making life-changing decisions about worship, whether Orpah is going to go back to her gods or Ruth is going to follow to have the God of Israel, I do not think that it is a stretch to say that this word turn is essential and important for us. I think we could also say this. If someone in the Old Testament, an author, wanted to have this idea of repentance, they are probably going to use this word, shuv. So I want to take just a moment before we move on to say a few things about what we learn from this scene, and that is that turning is essential on the path of redemption. You see, just like Ruth and Orpah or Naomi, on the path of life, we must make decisions as well. And in relationship to God, there are really just two choices on the shelf, as the old saying goes. There are only two ways. We must turn one of two directions. Every person on this earth will either turn toward God and his people or away from God and his people. You and I will make, and actually already have made, a decision about that. And I think that chapter 1 keeps this idea of turning before us to make us realize that it's not just Ruth and Orpah who make these type of decisions. Because it's not just on the road from Moab to Bethlehem that life-changing spiritual decisions are made. I think that this is a metaphor for every human life as well. Every person will make a decision just like Ruth and Orpah. Either a life lived in pursuit of God and his people or a life spent turning away from God and his people. I want to be careful here, but I think it's interesting that Ruth, when she states this earlier, she says, "I choose, your people will be my people and your God my God." That's why I include God's people here. Naomi makes it clear in her appeal. Ruth makes it clear. And all throughout the Bible, it's clear as well. To choose God is to choose God's people as well. I wish I could take some more time on this point, but I want to make one quick appeal before moving on to the next scene. Can I just ask you, have you ever turned to God?
Have you ever turned to God?
Before you answer this question, I want to point one other thing out about turning. A turn toward God is a turn away from something else. We see this with both Ruth and Naomi. Naomi had followed her husband away from the promised land into a sojourn, or we could even call it an exile, into the land of Moab. Now she has turned her back on her previous waywardness and at least provisionally is turning back to God and his people. Ruth also is turning her back on everything that she has known. Supremely, her people and her God, and now she is expressing her faith that this is the one true way for her. You see, on the path of life, just as on the path of Moab, between Moab and Bethlehem, the choice of which way to turn is central. Your life is no different. You must choose. But let me say this and be very clear. A choice of God is a choice against your own previous way of life. We learned last time that sin is at the background of every story, and so that means that every person is going to have to turn away from that. To turn in the right direction toward God necessitates a turn away from your own waywardness and rebellion. We all must realize that we've actually done a lousy job of running our own lives and instead own up to the truth that God actually knows exactly what he's talking about. And that, if we could say it like this then, and then we cling to him. And then we cling to him. We turn and we trust. So these ideas of turning and trusting are really united together. And the reality is that you too will cling to someone. Let's go to scene number three. Scene number three. This is our longest one and maybe our last, depending on how much time this takes. This takes us to a totally different scene. Now we're back in Bethlehem. We're back and they have arrived and we've had this conversation at the gate. Now we're going to somewhere else. We're going to the fields of a man named Boaz. We're going to look at the first 16 verses here, but I want to tell you something else, something that we learn from this scene. And it'll be clear at the end, but just listen for now. Going is essential on the path of redemption. We have turning and we have trusting. And now we also have going, movement. I'm going to split this up into two kind of smaller scenes so we don't read as much text at once. So at this point, I would like for you to read chapter 2, verses 1 to 7 with me. We're going to find that Ruth goes to glean, and she happens to glean in Boaz's field. Ruth 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is that?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is the young woman, Moabite woman, who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers, after the sheaves." Then she came and remained from the morning until now. And she's been sitting in the house for a little while. All right, a number of things here. This passage opens up with talking about a kinsman who's related to Naomi. And can anybody say foreshadowing? I mean, this just sounds like a setup, right? Starting a new scene, and especially if we were back in those days and we had any idea about how some of these relationships work, we realize that if there's a close relative, then there may be some great hope for these two women, these two widows. And so narrative masters, like the author of this, know exactly how to perk up our attention, and he's got it. He's got our attention. Our attention is immediately raised, and we wonder what part this kinsman might play in Ruth and Naomi's story. What I want to quickly, I've mentioned the word glean a few times, and verse 2 brings it up because Ruth asks Naomi for permission to go and glean. And I think that this is important to understand what's going on here in that culture. It's very different from our day, so let's just take a quick moment and say, what does it mean to glean? In short, it would mean this, that those landowners who had lots and lots of land and they're plowing their fields, they're getting their grains, well, just like anything, you can't always get every piece of grain, right? There's going to be some that falls down, and maybe even sometimes one of the workers drops part of a sheaf or maybe even a whole sheaf after they've reaped. Well, gleaning was something set up in Israel, and actually there are a number of ancient Near Eastern cultures that would have something like this, where those who were poor and destitute, they would be able to come into the fields after the reaping was done, and they would be able to pick up the scraps, so to speak. There are actually laws throughout the Old Testament that speak of this, and I want to read you one, because I want you to see how God is providing for people like Ruth and Naomi, how he's concerned for their needs. Deuteronomy 24, verses 19 to 22, is a law that's written to landowners. When you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, it's like God is making very clear that I'm talking about everything. You shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and the widow. Now listen to this. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. God says to his people, you know what it's like to have nothing. You know what it's like to be in a place where you might not have known where your next meal was coming from. Remember that and provide. Now, this is not the point of today's lesson, but I think I should at least say it. God's economy, if we call it like that, was structured to provide for the poor. It was not structured to negate wealth, but rather to share it. I think this reminds us that God is not necessarily against wealth, but he is against greed and the worship of wealth. Instead, he intends for the wealth that he disperses to be shared with those who need it. I think that this gives us something that we can be reminded of as Christians, that the more we have, the more responsible we are to be conduits of God's generosity. That's what God says to landowners, and that's what God says to really anybody who lives in what may be the richest nation in the world today. So, since we have freely received, we should freely give. Now, one of the things that I think is so interesting, though, about this is it seems that somehow Ruth understood these gracious laws of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Whether it was through Naomi or through word of mouth or whether even maybe her husband told her while in Moab, we don't know, but she learned it and she believed. Do you notice that? She said, let me go and glean and gather. She believed that God, the God of Israel, would provide for her through people who were obedient to him. And so she acted in faith of God's provision. And it comes about that she departed and she goes and gleans in the field after the reapers. And I want to point you to the middle of verse 3, one of the most maybe powerful statements, but one that we could read over in chapter 2. It says, she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. Now, this could also be translated in this way, and I love this. Her chance chanced. She's like, it's trying to make it seem as, if we could say, random as possible. Her chance just chanced upon this guy who could be their hope. I think it's a very interesting little phrase. And again, I'm going to come back to this. Great authors can say so much with so little. A short turn of phrase can set our minds on fire as we pursue its significance. I mean, so far the author has been trying to say how God is in control of everything. He's in control of why Naomi is so bitter. He's in control of where Ruth is going and Orpah is going. So far the author's made so clear that God is in the details. Why now would we bring in chance and random happenings?
I think it's clearly trying to point the idea of a chance or random happening, but we're going to have to think about why. Why is that? Well, we'll make a statement about that in a moment. But for now, I want to continue on. Because now, in verse 4, we begin to see this man Boaz. And one of the great things in any story, to be able to get to know the characters, is to look at the way they speak, right? We know this from the Bible, we know this just from life experience, that you get to really know someone by what comes out of their mouth, right? Out of the depths of the heart, the mouth speaks, the Bible teaches this. And so I think as we go through this story, one of the great things about Ruth is the author gives us many, many windows into the character of people through their conversations. And this is the first time we hear from Boaz, so I think it's important for us to see what type of man is this. Well, we find that these words that come out of Boaz's mouth, when the first thing he says to his workers is, "May the Lord be with you," it seems to point us to a couple things. First of all, I think clearly Boaz's piety, his desire to include the Lord in everything that is going on in his life, even the way that he greets his workers, God enters into that. But I think we can go further. It would probably come as no surprise to you that in the ancient Near East, not every landowner would have had such a joyful blessing as their greeting to their workers, right? Boaz is different, though. Now, the thing that even goes a step further than that is look at his workers' response to him. "May the Lord bless you." Now, can I ask you this? So they respond in kind. They echo this blessing for blessing. And how often in those days or in ours does a boss walk in to the resounding blessing of his workers? Probably not as often as we might like to think, right? But I think all of this is giving us a feel for who this man is. This is a man, a godly man, a man who not just says good things with his life, but whose workers can attest that this man is the real deal. We get the feeling that this is just the type of man that Boaz is. He's a man of blessing and a man whom others think is deserving of blessing. Now, we're going to have to continue to develop our understanding of him as we work our way through. Verses 5 to 7, I'm not going to spend much time on. This is a conversation between Boaz and the overseer of his reapers. The main thing that I want to point out here is that not only does Ruth happen to come on Boaz's field that day, but so also does this wealthy landowner just happen to see that she came on his fields that day. Sure are a lot of serendipitous coincidences in this story, aren't there? But I think that leads us to what I want to take maybe a little rabbit trail here for a second. Here's what I want to say. I think we see from this first section that random chance is not a thing in God's universe. Say that again. Random chance is not a thing in God's universe. And the author has prepared us to make this assertion by just a small phrase, that her chance chanced. He actually uses the language of random happenings to subvert it and say there ain't no random happenings here. Naomi has seen God's hand in her, the fulfillment of his covenant curses, right? We've seen that throughout the story so far, God has been at work and nothing has changed. Ruth didn't happen to get there. Boaz didn't happen to see her. God set up this meeting. God provides. He provided a long time before, in one sense, through these laws for landowners to say, because of my deliverance of you, because of what you've experienced from me, you now reproduce that in sharing your wealth with others. And then he also provides, and if I can make a verb of this, he providences. He is, as the sovereign king of the universe, he is working all these events for connecting relationships and to bring about his will. Things that seem to be random are actually God's hand at work. Let's continue on. Verses 8 to 16, the second part of this scene, is where now we're going to see some conversation taking place between Boaz and Ruth. So if we read verses 8 to 16 now.
Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I've commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found such favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to seek refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your sight, my lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip of your piece of bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain. She ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, "Let her glean, even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. And you shall purposefully pull out grain from the bundles and leave it, that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." So, a lot here, and we need to begin to wind up. So we're not going to spend a lot of time, but I do want to see Boaz's first words to Ruth. This first conversation is really important. He begins by saying, "Listen carefully, my daughter," which expresses concern for her, her well-being, care for her. It's also the very affectionate terminology that Naomi has been using throughout. He also then goes on to tell her, "Don't go anywhere else. We're going to take care of you, take care for you here." He even tells her, "Don't just wait until they're done with the field. Don't go to the field that they did yesterday or whatever. You keep your eyes on the one that they're doing today, and you go right behind them. Anything that drops is yours." And Boaz is giving her permission to go right after them, which is the very best. He also says he's commanding his servants not to touch her. I mean, something for a widow that could very easily come about is she would need to be protected when she's by herself. And he says, I am making sure you will not be touched in this field. So he's not just then providing for her protection and food, though. He provides for her to get water so she is sure to not get dehydrated. And he says, go and drink where everyone else drinks. You see, Boaz has thought through everything. He's making sure that she's going to be taken care of in his fields. He shows concern. He shows compassion. Can I just ask, how lacking is this in our business world, right? Not only do we reap over every corner of our fields, looking for every last cent of profit, but we would never go further than necessary with charity. Think about this. Maybe we would do charity things or charity opportunities if the cameras were rolling, right? Good PR. But out of the kindness of our heart or out of gratuity, no. But this is exactly how Boaz operates here. Let's not move on without noticing that Boaz's first words toward Ruth are self-sacrificial, thoughtful, and concerned. We're getting more and more a picture of who this man is. Ruth is overwhelmed in verse 10. She falls to the ground. She realizes that this is not normal. And she's overwhelmed by his kindness, and there are two things that particularly overwhelm her. The first is his favor. Both times that Ruth speaks to Boaz, she mentions his favor. The fact that he is in giving unmerited favor to her, and she cannot understand why. And particularly, the reason that she cannot understand why, the other thing that's on her mind is that she is a foreigner. She's especially taken back because she is not even a native Israelite. Now, Boaz then goes on to tell her that he knows of her situation, and then he even says that he's seeking God's blessing on her for her decisions. And I think it's also interesting that Boaz recognizes, just like Ruth did, just like Naomi did, the nature of her decision to come. I hope that we did not miss that in verse 12. Look at what he says. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Her coming to Israel was an allegiance to the God of Israel, seeking refuge from Yahweh himself. So Ruth is blown away that she has no connection to him that she is aware of, and yet he has been so kind to her. And then verses 14 to 16, I'm not going to go over much other than to just say this. Boaz is not just a good talker. He makes clear that the things that he has said actually come about. He makes sure that she is taken care of. And I just want to say at this moment one quick application before we wrap up this point. A life of kindness is a right fit for your story. Don't we love a Boaz character? Don't we love this? Well, do you know what? It's a right fit for your story too, and mine. This is how life is supposed to be. This type of man who's compassionate, concerned, caring, giving. This is a right fit for all of our stories who know Christ. That it should be like if the story was written on our lives, people have a sigh of relief when we walk onto the scene, just like we do with Boaz. Well, let me tell you, we're not going to go to our fourth scene, as I thought, but let me tell you what the word is I want to pull out from this scene. It's the word to go. It occurs 12 times in what we've read today. And it also occurred 5 times in what we read last time, bringing the total to 17 times in what we've read so far in chapters 1 and 2. And I think that this is even more significant when we read the last two chapters. It only occurs one time. There's a reason that the author is trying to give us this idea of movement, of going, of action. Here's what I want to say. Going is essential on the path of redemption too. We see this in a few ways. We see this in the scene before us by Ruth's action. She responds to her need. She doesn't just wait for something to happen. She assumes upon the lawful conduct of God and his people, and she acts in faith. I think it's amazing to see this interplay between inability and yet action. From one standpoint, Ruth cannot do anything. She doesn't have a field or a farm. She doesn't have money. She doesn't have family connections that she knows of. And yet, from another standpoint, she acts in faith of what she knows about God, and this whole thing is about action. And God provided for her and people like her through his law, and she takes action in faith, believing God's action. Can I just say it like this? Pursuit of redemption is active. I wish we had more time for this, but in all of our lives, when we were, those of us who are Christians, when we were turned to trust Christ, there was something that really motivated us to go and seek him. And we had to actively respond to that prompting. We could not just be passive and hope that something would happen to us. Our response is not a work in a theological sense. We don't take credit for it, and yet we have an active role in pursuing it. Our action, if we could call it that, is merely the movement of faith toward God, assuming upon his promised response. I wish we had time to talk. The old Puritan preachers would call this this teaching, they talk about the awakened sinner. You can read Jonathan Edwards or John Owen, who would speak about the time when someone woke up to the fact that they were in sin and that they needed Christ. And what they would exhort their congregations and people who were in that state, they would say this: don't turn away from that. Pursue the Lord. Listen to him. Respond to him. Call out to him. Don't just wait. Respond by actively doing your part to pursue a true knowledge of God. And so can I say something really quickly to those of you in that category? Some of you have probably been here maybe many weeks. You've heard the gospel. You know the truth. And you are considering it. You are thinking about the Lord. Let me encourage you. Be active. Get help answering your spiritual questions. Read the Bible for yourself, especially the portions that tell about Christ and his gospel. Pray and ask God for insight into his truth. And do not delay calling on Christ for salvation from your sins. You see, going is essential on the path of redemption. There is so much action, and yet there's so much dependence. Well, Scene four, and we'll get to it last week. What I wanted to say is that when there's also necessary for the Redeemer to be on the path of redemption. You got to go somewhere. You got to end at a Redeemer, and that's what we'll talk about next week. We'll talk about who the Redeemer is in this story, and then we'll broaden it out, and it's no surprise who the Redeemer is in our story. But I want to wrap up by saying what we've learned and then make a closing application. We have learned that trusting is essential on the path of redemption, that turning is essential on the path of redemption, that going is essential, and of course, there is a Redeemer that must be there. Can I encourage us all, whether for the first time or for however many times as a Christian, like we talked about with repentance and faith this morning, let me encourage you, make the right turn. Evidence the right trust. Make sure you're trusting and clinging to the right people. Make sure you are progressive, that you are going, that you are active. And finally, make sure you're always going toward the Redeemer. Have you ever turned? Have you ever trusted? If you have, are you sure that you have done so in the direction of the only Redeemer, the Lord Jesus Christ? Orpah turned. She trusted, but she went the wrong way. Which way have you gone? And then believers, I just want to say this, as we talked about at the opening of the service, though this takes place, yes, once at a moment at conversion, it is to be repeated every day. We are turning and trusting in Him day after day after day. And so, for everyone in the room today, there should be a way for you to apply this message that we have seen from Ruth, to turn and trust as you go toward your Redeemer. Let's pray.